Hi, folks. This is John Suntress from WordBalloon.com. Before we start our show, I wanted to play this special message from some of my friends from Cryptographic.
Hey, everyone out there. This is Damien from Cryptographic, and welcome to Heavenside. Josh Mendels, who we know from work as 30 Days of Night, Horrorcide, Dial M for Murder, he's fighting for his life at the moment with cancer. Now, one thing that I would really like to do is to put out there that Boom Studios is actually doing an anthology-type book for him. It's actually got a cover by Ben Temple Smith. There's actually an alternate cover that's done by Josh himself. You've got Steve Niles, who does a prose story in there. B. Clay Moore's got the start of his Blue Jacket series, which he's hoping to actually come up into a series next year, so if you want to jump on top of that, you should grab that one. You have Joshua Fialkov doing a story in there, sort of a cowboy western type thing in there as well, and Cody Chamberlain, who we all know from Punks the Comic, is going to be doing something in there as well. I really urge anybody who hasn't actually picked it up to try to order this book. There's two order codes for it. For the ones with the Ben Temple Smith cover, it's JUL083759, and that book is $3.99. For the special donation cover by Josh Mendels, the code is JUL083758. Now, that one going for $9.99. Boom is actually giving all proceeds of this to Josh, since, you know, a lot of the artists over there don't have health insurance, and fighting cancer is something that's really hard for a lot of people out there. I've lost quite a few friends actually to cancer myself, so I really want to actually support this one and get you guys to get it. If you're going to San Diego this year, if you hear this before you go to San Diego, I really recommend going and picking up a copy there at the Boom booth. It's really going to a worthwhile cause, because, you know, it's hard when we all donate for creators who have long gone, and this is one who's still around, and we want him to be able to beat this thing. Okay, thanks for your time.
Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. This weekend is the San Diego Comic-Con, and as usual, the Eisner Awards will be happening, and many of the creators that you hear here on Word Balloon are up for Eisners, and we wish everybody luck, but there can only be a chosen few that actually walk away with the hardware. Today we feature an interview with someone who's got to have a lot of plaques on her wall, I imagine, from Dark Horse Comics, editor Diana Schutz, who will be sharing some stories about the books she's supervised from some great creators, like Jeff Smith, Matt Wagner, and Michael Chabon. A lot of our talk revolves around the deals that happen between creators and publishers. Diana also talks about her special relationship with creators like Will Eisner, Frank Miller, Harlan Ellison, and her, at the time, in the works, Women of Comics anthology called Sexy Chicks. Some great and interesting stories from Diana Schutz. We hope you enjoy the show. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off the cover price, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. In fact, right now, you can get both volumes of the Escapist trade paperbacks, and they're incredible collections, so densely filled with stories and by some amazing creators. The retail price for those are $17.95 each, but you can get Volume 1 or Volume 2 for just $11.67 at InStockTrades.com. And don't forget to visit InStockTrades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, monthly specials 45 to 75% off every month. For more details, visit InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. We start things off with our talk with Diana Schutz, discussing how Dark Horse managed to secure the rights to The Escapists from Michael Chabon.
It started with Mike Richardson contacting Michael Chabon, although I had read Michael's novel, of course, before it won the Pulitzer Prize. And I met Michael Chabon at the very same convention. It was San Diego, I think, 2001. In fact, I had Will Eisner introduce me to Michael. I poked Will in the sides and said, you know, introduce me to that guy you promised me. So I met Michael at the San Diego Con of 2001, but I'm, you know, not in a position to sort of make deals of that sort. Mike Richardson, unknown by me, approached him at that convention and began talking to him about licensing The Escapist, about making a comic book based on The Escapist character. Of course, I believe it was Paul Levitz at DC Comics did the same thing. So Dark Horse and DC were vying with each other for the rights to do this comic book.
So were there big limo parties and dinners promised and lots of wining and dining to get Michael to come to Dark Horse?
I don't think so. I think it came down to, really, I think what it came down to was that, I guess that Mike promised Michael we would serve him better, that we had a track record of not just doing standard type work with our licensed properties, but that we went, you know, we had a history of doing very well by licensed properties and treating them the same way we create our own properties, for instance. So, and I think that, you know, I believe that finally swayed Michael Chabon. But then, you know, I can't swear to it. Perhaps there were limos and paid women, and I'm sure there were lots of dollars involved as well. But well, luckily, I'm kind of out of that whole end of things.
No, that's cool. And I would say that you're right. I think that the end result in a lot of Dark Horse's products show the commitment to the licensed products, and that it is a little bit different than what you might see at other publishers, because I would say the Star Wars books, for example, are given as much care, it seems, as, mm-hmm. say, the Mignola Hellboy books.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a set of story parameters that Chabon created or that you guys at Dark Horse created, you know, what you're looking for as far as The Escapist? Because the great thing about the anthology is you've got so many different writing and art styles, and you really do seem to take advantage of the blank slate that comes with The Escapist to go in a lot of directions.
Well, and that's, of course, what makes the book so much fun. There is both a Michael Chabon-dictated Bible and a Dark Horse-dictated Bible, and they're all subsumed kind of under one umbrella. But the Bible sort of begins and ends with this wonderful article entitled Escapism 101 by Malachi B. Cohen, who is Michael by any other name. And it's the spurious, of course, publication history of The Escapist, beginning in the 1940s with the Empire Comics version with Amazing Midget Radio Comics, mm-hmm. number one, and sort of taking into account all the stuff that was postulated in The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. But then it goes from there. Michael extrapolated beyond that into the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. And I have commissioned other writers to sort of expand on what Michael set up. We actually printed this publication history and have printed other sort of articles that explore in depth The Escapist in any of the different eras. So we've now created this incredibly twisted kind of historical publication context for The Escapist, and one of the Dark Horse requirements now for any writer attempting to tackle an Escapist story is that the writer situate the story somewhere within that context, that historical publication context. So I guess that's, you know, that's the prime thing, is that no one can write a story that is simply a story featuring this costume character who gets out of traps. It has to make sense on a lot of different levels. However, at the heart of each story, you know, it's not enough to simply be, well, here we're going to do a 60s Superman parody, you know, something,
sure.
that pokes fun at the Mort Weisinger style Superman family, mm-hmm. titles. That's not enough. At the heart of every single story, there's got to be the theme of liberation and escape. So those are the kinds of
parameters
that we impose.
Okay.
Here.
And it's great because clearly the writers have leapt to it because, as you say, with each decade, there was a different faux company, you know, running The Escapist. And
yeah.
I spoke to Stephen Grant a few weeks ago, and he brought up his own piece with Norm Breitfogel, Weird Love. which was wonderful. And I wonder if that's also opened doors to other possible escapist stories that really didn't feature the escapist.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Chris Offutt, who is sort of renowned as a novelist, but who, you know, who has a serious Jones for comics and wrote his very first comic story in Escapist number 6 called Another Man's Escape. Chris is a Guggenheim Fellow, a Lannan and Whiting Award winner. I mean, he's sort of a much celebrated literary writer. His second story for The Escapist focuses on the four freedoms, which are briefly mentioned in about one sentence in Cavalier and Clay. But again, in the novel, Michael Chabon postulated that Cavalier and Clay had created numerous characters in comic series, and so that whole field is wide open for us to play with.
And it's been great because, you know, it's so nice to see Howard Chaykin doing a Howard Chaykin type of story, but it's clearly an escapist story as well. And you've had such great creators kind of put their own imprint. Jim Starlin doing the cosmic Luna Moth story and just a lot of fun fitting it into the escapist world.
Yeah, well, and, you know, first of all, it's great fun for me because it gives me a repository for all my arcane knowledge of comics history. And
yeah.
Then so many of these guys either, you know, were coming along at those various periods in history or, like me, are total comics history buffs. And so it's, you know, it's sort of a joy to play with all of that stuff. Again, I don't think you really need to know. I don't think you really need to know comics history to appreciate the stories because
sure.
they have to work on the level of story. But for those who do have, you know, even a basic knowledge of the history of the industry, there are so many bonuses.
Absolutely.
For them, yeah.
Well, and for me. I'm one of those fans as well. I'm one of those guys that grew up on reading the 80-page giants, the old 80-page giants. We should mention that The Escapist itself is an 80-page giant.
Yes, it is. God help me. Yes,
that's
it
cool.
Is.
But that's cool. I mean, it really is. You know, at first, I think that, you know, people might be put off when they initially see that, you know, for a quarterly, that it might seem like an expensive book, but these really are. It's an anthology, but it's a dense anthology. Not only several stories, but as you say, the text pieces that if you are an old-time comic book fan, you're going to love them. I should ask, obviously, there's going to be a change in terms of one of the stories, I'm assuming, as far as the ongoing issues go, and that's, is that Brian K. Vaughan's section?
Yes, it is. It sort of, you know, it became clear to me. I mean, first of all, anthologies are kind of hard to sell to begin with.
Sure.
And no matter how great the individual stories are, the book comes out quarterly. It's $9. And that's, even though, you know, let's take an average price comic these days is about $3.
Right.
You get 22 pages of story for about $3. Here you're getting more than 66 pages of story
yep.
for $3 times $3. So, you know, in terms of the math, it works out. But in terms of the perceived thing, when people go into the store every 3 months, they see this $9 entity waiting.
Sure.
And no matter how many pages or good stories, you know, after a time, people wind up falling off. They wind, you know, anthologies just don't have a very good success rate in comics. I wanted to be able to bring people back, and I started thinking about what brings me back to a comic, and the simple answer is continuity, caring about certain characters and finding out, well, what's going to happen next issue, what's going to happen to this one, and so on. And so So I approached Brian Vaughan and asked him to set up an ongoing storyline for a minimum of 8 issues, and the first chapter sees print next month in issue number 8.
And these are not, this isn't a story about Cavalier and Clay. This is about two new writer, or a new writer and artist team that
this
are...
This is kind of like ultimate Cavalier and Clay.
Okay.
it's a latter day Cavalier and Clay team, a latter day writer artist team who resurrect the dormant license for the escapist and begin writing and drawing and publishing their own escapist stories. But just like the novel, the overarching storyline has to do with the two creators. And then every so often we actually go into the comic that they create. And Brian is so talented.
You bet.
He skillfully weaves in and out of the two different storylines so that the one begins to mirror the other. It's quite mind-blowing. And to me as an editor, to get these scripts in from him and to see that he's doing things that just have not been done before. He's in the writing of this ongoing storyline. He's doing things that just have not been done before in comics. So that's very exciting to me, both as a reader and as an editor.
No, I think that's great. I think that's really neat, and I think Vaughn is the kind of creator right now that people are starting to recognize really how amazing of a writer he is.
I should hope so. He won Best Writer in the Eisner Awards.
Well, you're a recipient yourself for The Escapist. I saw that it won Best Anthology, and I wonder, as you describe what's going to happen with Vaughn's storyline, is this the most different book that you've edited on a consistent basis?
Yes, it is, and you know, again, it allows me to play with all the different eras of comics history, which I really enjoy. It's been a long time since I have sort of seriously edited work for hire material.
Okay.
I'm used to working primarily with creator owners who produce their own material.
Yes.
And who own their own material, like Paul Chadwick on Concrete, mm-hmm. or Stan Sakai and Usagi Yojimbo, and even Matt on Grendel, where he's at least writing the stories. So it's been a while since I've sort of been, I guess, actively involved in shaping a comic book, and I'm finding myself really, really enjoying that. You know, with the creator-owned stuff, I'm sort of as involved or not as the creator wants me to be. With the two Grendel anthologies, for instance, mm-hmm. The Black, White, and Red, and then the subsequent Red, White, and Black.
Yes.
Matt was much more involved in selecting the artists,
okay,
for those anthologies than I was. By the same token, I've gotten to fool around with little black and white anthologies, creator-owned anthologies. There was a Happy Endings anthology in 2002, and then Autobiographics in 2003. And this year, God willing, in December, it'll be out, an anthology entitled Sexy Chicks, which is my all-girl cartoonist anthology. And with those also, I'm actively involved in selecting the cartoonists, but less so in terms of working with them on the kinds of stories they want to tell. With Escapist, I'm a little more involved because I'm sort of shepherding that character for Michael and making sure that things are consistent with our faux history line.
How often will Michael himself continue to contribute Escapist stories?
You know, I guess as often as he gets a hankering to write one.
Okay.
The Mr. Machine Gun story came about quite by accident. Dean Haspiel had wanted to do a Mr. Machine Gun story. Again, another sort of throwaway character name from the novel. And Dean had done a couple of possible pinups of Mr. Machine Gun, and I sent those off to Michael. And Michael sort of, Dean wasn't seeing the character quite as Michael did, and it got Michael thinking and interested in that character, and he just kind of sat down and started writing a comic book story.
Oh, that's great.
And then it kept going on and on and on and on, and it wound up in its original form. I believe it was 62 pages long, and we sort of worked together to repace it a little bit, and ultimately, you know, it turned into 76 pages, drawn by the magnificent Eduardo Barreto.
Great story.
It just, you know, it came about because Michael just sort of got a hankering to develop this Mr. Machine Gun character.
It was a great story. It was a wonderful story.
And I thought so, and especially, really, it's, you know, it was one of Michael's first times at bat, really, in the world of comics.
Sure. Yeah, he's probably still under 10 comic book stories, really, proper comic book stories.
I think under 5.
I think you're right. I was being generous, but that's really cool.
That is really cool.
it was really neat, and I love the concept of the character, and it fleshed out really nice, and yeah, I'm all for future stories about Mr. Machine Gun. I think that was really neat.
Well, and I'm all for future stories by Michael, period, and any, you know, any comic book stories, of course, would be great. He's just finished his, within the last month, he finished his new novel.
Yes.
The Yiddish Policeman's Union, and of course, I'm already dying to read that, though I don't think the book comes out until the spring. So.
Okay. Are you guys finding, and I don't know how much you all discuss this at Dark Horse, but that hiring the authors to do comic books, is it bringing more of the authors, you know, regular novel readers into the comic book world? Or, you know, are you finding that kind of sales bounce?
You know, we'd love to find that kind of sales bounce, but to be honest, I don't really think it's happening, or at least it's not happening in the way that we'd like it to happen, and part of the problem is the way graphic novels are racked in the bookstores. They're all racked together under graphic novels. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a Japanese cutie pie book or a dark adults-only crime fiction book.
Right.
You know, Sin City is sitting right next to Oh My Goddess, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, is sitting right next to The Amazing Adventures of the Escapist, as if graphic novels were a genre instead of the format that they are. So, unfortunately, people who are not aware of Michael's comics work are not necessarily going to see it because the graphic novels are not sitting next to The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Similarly, Sin City is not racked in the crime fiction section of most bookstores. So, you know, unless a prose reader sort of, you know, is inclined to go check out the graphic novel section, we're not seeing that kind of crossover in the way that we'd like.
Before we leave The Escapist, I should, you know, acknowledge Will Eisner's Final Spirit story as well.
Yeah.
And really, it was so nice and, you know, certainly unfortunate that it was one of his last works, but the guy really went out swinging. I mean, he really, that and especially the plot as well, clearly, you know, the man was still at the height of his talent, and it really hadn't gone away with age, which was so nice to see. Can you talk about getting that final story? Because it sounded like from your introduction to the book and stuff that it was kind of a, you know, tapping Will's shoulder every now and then.
He didn't want to do it. I mean, as I, you know, as I wrote in that intro, no, he did not want to do it. But I had a wonderful, wonderful relationship with Will, and it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that, you know, he was very much a surrogate father, and we just got along so tremendously. I adored the man above and beyond his amazing accomplishments in comics. I just loved Will, you know, that simple. And Will loved me back.
That's cool.
So when I asked him to do this story, he hemmed and hawed and shuffled his feet, but ultimately he couldn't really say no, and beyond which I was able to offer him something in trade that he did want. which was Michael Chabon writing the introduction to Will's biography written by Bob Andelman.
Wow.
So yeah, he didn't really want to do it. He put off doing it, and I'd mention it from time to time to him, and he'd sort of hem and haw. And finally, I just called him up and said, look, you know, I know that you don't really want to do this thing. You're done with the spirit. You're done with telling these sorts of adventure stories. So I'll make it an adventure story. He said, why does it have to be that? Why don't you just have these two characters meeting up in a bar and talking about how stupid it is that they have to wear masks or something?
Sure.
And, you know, because I said we can go anywhere with Escapist. We can pretty much do anything. So that finally got him interested. When he realized that, you know, he did not have to do a traditional Pursuit and Vengeance, that he could sort of go outside the boundaries of that if he were so inclined. And then, so then he did, in the context of a Pursuit and Vengeance story.
Yes.
So, you know, that was, I mean, God. And then, you know, the last time I spoke with him, I had called the studio when I got the pages, and I reached an answering machine, and Mrs. Simpson, his assistant, called me back the next day and said, you know, we got your message that you received the pages, and but, you know, Will, sorry, he wasn't able to call you, but he's in the hospital right now. And I was like, what?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, cut to, I spoke with him the night before his surgery, and he told me that he, you know, he'd waited, I hate to even think this, he'd waited until he'd finished the story before going to the doctor.
Wow.
And the doctor told him, you know, do not, please, you know, go right to the hospital right
yeah.
now. I guess he was, you know, he said that he had been tired and a shortness of breath and so on. But, you know, it was sort of a mark of Will's professionalism that he was not going to let anything slow him down, stop him. You know, with Will, the job always came first. And he just, yeah, he was at the top of his game still. He was still, you know, 87 years old, about to turn 88 in March, and he was sharp as a tack still, you know.
I was fortunate to see him in 2002. He came to Chicago for the Humanities Festival. The University of Chicago put it on.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil Gaiman was there, and Art Spiegelman, too. And it was so nice. Neil interviewed Will for the hour, and then Will hung out and spoke to people, and it was great. It, you know, like after a lecture, going up to talk to the teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he was such a joy. And it was. It's so nice to see. Yes, so lucid, so much a part of the business still,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
such a wonderful perspective of being there literally from the start to the modern day, and could really tell you with a clarity that few of his age, you know, his peers, and there aren't that many peers that are still active or out there to speak to, that have the clarity and the recall that Will had. And it was such a pleasure to hear.
And also just the, you know, he always had time for anyone who loved comics. He always made time for anyone who loved comics. You know, it didn't matter who you were. It didn't matter how many awards you'd won. It didn't matter, you know, it didn't matter if you owned a publishing company or if you were making little mini comics. If you loved comics, Will made time for you. It was that simple. You know, and he treated you as a peer, as an equal. He, you know, he wasn't looking down from the lofty heights, which he could so easily have done.
Sure.
and you know, earned every bit of that. But he didn't. Will just, you know, he loved comics so, and he loved everyone who shared that passion.
Was Last Day in Vietnam your first book with Will?
Yes, it was.
What a great book. It really is. It's such a wonderful book. The fact that you use the, and if I say this wrong, sepia-toned pages, the tan pages?
Sepia, yes. Okay. Well, that was all Will's idea. He wanted to give it that period feel.
Yeah.
That sort of landed on our doorstep kind of at the last minute, too. Originally, it would have been part of the whole package of Eisner graphic novels that went off to DC Comics, but it came to us because it was sort of late in the day, you know, it was like April of that year or something, and the book was done. Will wanted it out in time for the San Diego convention a couple months later.
Okay.
And DC is a lot larger than we are, and you know, they have a lot more hoops to jump through.
Sure.
And we're a smaller company and owned by one guy who can sort of bulldoze all those hoops if he's so inclined. And he was so inclined. So DC, you know, had said, no, we're just not able to get it out for you in time for San Diego. And we, Dark Horse, sort of bent over backwards to make it happen. And I actually use that book in my comics art history and criticism course that I teach for two reasons. One, because I need to introduce the students to Will's work, and two, because it's a sop to Dark Horse. It's the one textbook that's published by Dark Horse.
How many books did you work with Eisner on?
Just the one graphic novel, because as I say, after that...
Everything
went to D.C.
Okay.
But there was the Will Eisner sketchbook. I guess shortly, to go chronologically, after Last Day in Vietnam, I believe the next project was Shop Talk, which was a collection of interviews Will had done in the 80s with various cartoonists, mostly... cartoonists from the 40s and 50s, but he had done these interviews, you know, some 30 years later, and they'd been published in one of the Kitchen Sink magazines, perhaps Will Eisner...
The Quarterly?
Will Eisner Quarterly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, we collected those interviews, re-edited them, put them all together under cover of one book. So that would have been the next thing. Then I believe following that, we did Hawks of the Seas. Again, Dennis Kitchen had published it, but had published it in a big, giant, sort of original art-size book, the hardcover of which went out of print very quickly. We published it in a more reader-friendly format. I'd never read it before.
That was Will's first strip, Before the Spirit.
It was Before the Spirit. He started working on that thing when he was 19.
Wow.
And, you know, when I first sat down to read it, my expectations were kind of low because I thought, well, you know, all right, this is Will Eisner, but hell, he was 19 years old, and it's a story about pirates, and I'm an old broad, and I'm not really that into pirates, you know. And, you know, I got sucked right in. I couldn't put it down.
That's cool.
And not only was the story compelling to me, but watching Will's development as an artist was fascinating. Just in the 2 years that he worked on that strip, and it was done for the foreign market, he had to provide a page a week, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Worked on it for 2 years. And you can really see from the first pages that cram, like, you know, whatever it is, 9 or 12 panels on a page. And as he's about 6 months into it, the pages start to open up, and you see him begin to experiment with, you know, larger panels for purposes of pacing and so on. It's pretty, you know, it's amazing just sort of from that academic perspective as well. But also, the story was just damn good.
That's
pirates
cool.
Notwithstanding.
No, that's cool, and it does sound like it's a textbook in itself in terms of his evolution.
Yes, absolutely. So there were those three, and then the sketchbook, which, you know, I had all that beautiful all those wonderful pages, that penciled pages that Will had hung on to.
Yeah.
And that we were, Dennis Kitchen again had published a Will Eisner sketchbook, but I wanted to do something a little bit differently. Dennis had published sort of basically two pages to any given page of the sketchbook, and I really wanted to do a big, beautiful hardcover that would look like a big sketchbook. So we, you know, we went broke on getting the best possible paper and printing it not in black and white as Dennis had done, but in two colors, so that you could see not just black but the blue pencil underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And had Will write introductions, because each section of pencil sketches was taken from a given graphic novel, and Will wrote an introduction to each section talking about the development of the particular graphic novel, and so on. And then and there were some short stories in between. Will did an autobio story for Autobiographics. He also did a very short two-page story for a little 48-page comics anthology that I had done in 2001, called Dark Horse Maverick 2001. Mm-hmm. And then finally there was Eisner Miller, which I am so, so sad to say did not see print until 3 months after his death.
Wonderful book, though. It's so nice to hear, you know, creators talk shop and really get down to the meat of the things that frustrate each other, and to see the different perspectives. And it was great to read Eisner Miller. It's a wonderful book. What a great collection of conversations going into very interesting directions and very candid comments by both men. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated the candidness, and not from any salacious, you know, joy of, wow, I didn't know he hated that guy. But it really was just very interesting stories. And because I think people forget that Will was a boss. I mean, it's because he was such a good guy and willing to talk to people. And
although apparently he was pretty cheap.
Well, there's a reason why Kirby and those guys ultimately left. Yeah, you know, we understand that. How did that work? How did Eisner Miller work? How did it happen?
It started on the damn boat. In the year 2000, four of us were part of this comic book cruise. That would be Will, Frank Miller, Charles Brownstein, and myself.
Okay.
Somewhere in conversation between Will and Charles and Frank, the idea of this book came up. And I'm not sure whose idea it was. At various times, each one of them had claimed it as their own idea. But the bottom line was, it was a great idea. No matter whose it was a great idea.
You bet.
Originally, Will saw it as sort of, you know, one in a series of those sorts of books. But it was meant to be the solo effort that it is, I think. In any event, you know, sometime thereafter, this cruise, incidentally, was a cruise to benefit the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Imagine 1 week on a boat with all your favorite comic book creators and nothing to do but corner them and drink.
I hope they had enough booze.
On a cruise ship, you better believe it.
Sure.
All watered down, of course.
Well, yeah.
But the idea originated there. And I guess, you know, within a year or so, Charles Brownstein had become the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund,
mm-hmm.
and the idea began to sort of get put in motion. We sent Charles and Frank to Florida, and Charles did a very good job of directing the conversation. So then we had a big, huge transcript, which Charles and I sort of hacked away at until it was readable.
Is there enough extra material for another book, or are we?
No.
Okay.
No, and in fact, yeah, we didn't really hack away so much at it. Charles organized it all, God bless him, you know, into the various sections.
Mm-hmm.
that now constitute the book, and where it was, you know, where it was not readable, with the help of Will and Frank, we made it so. Because I'm sure you know, doing what you do, that lots of times the spoken word just does not really translate into the written word very well.
Right.
So.
No, definitely. That's why I like radio. in some cases. Let's talk about your project that you've come back from. You had mentioned that you had gone to talk with Jeff Smith about a new project.
I went to Columbus, Ohio to talk to Jeff about doing The Art of Bone. You know, Dark Horse has published a number of art books.
Mm-hmm.
We started with The Art of Sin City, then went on to do The Art of Hellboy and The Art of the Hellboy Movie, the Will Eisner Sketchbook, most recently The Art of Usagi Yojimbo. And I should say, in large part, the success of these has to do with their design. And the person, the common denominator there is a designer named Kiri Grazzini, who is also, you know, the manager of our design department and has been working for Dark Horse since he was a teenager, starting out sort of, you know, hefting boxes of stock for Mike Richardson's retail stores. Kiri, I think, is a brilliant designer. And again, I mean, it's one thing to have all this fabulous artwork, but it's another to give it a particular visual presentation that's as appealing as these have been.
The coffee table book treatment.
The coffee table book treatment, exactly. And I have to, you know, I have to give credit where it's due. That's all been Kiri's work.
Cool.
And I think it was Kiri's work that led Jeff to call and say, you know, would Dark Horse be interested in doing The Art of Bone? So I went out there to basically to get art. And Jeff and I spent basically about 3 days going through stuff that he had there and trying to figure out sort of the direction of the book, what the kinds of things were that we wanted to include in it. And basically that comes down to a lot of stuff that the public has not seen, some of Jeff's sort of, you know, very preliminary scripts and sketches and so on, you know, unused pages, as well as all the various tchotchkes that have been produced, you know, sort of the bone objects, as
okay.
it were, as well as, you know, there are, I mean, just going through the entire bone saga, Jeff is such a magnificent storyteller and has an incredible visual sensibility, and there are so many images from the actual story as well that I want to see in there, that Jeff wants to see in there. We have our favorite pages and panels and so on. And then, of course, there are all the various covers, alternate covers, the image covers. Anyway, the book, we intend for the book to be arranged chronologically, and 200 pages, full color.
Wow.
I mean, obviously, there will be a lot of black and white because he did bone in black and white.
Sure.
But we will take advantage of color.
Wow.
The reason that we began doing these things, the reason that I wanted to do originally The Art of Sin City, which was my idea,
mm-hmm.
was the fact that I would get in from Frank these amazing, you know, comic book pages that are 11 by 17. And they're just, they're lush, they're beautiful, they're engrossing. You forget about the story. It's, you know, you're just so captivated by the actual artwork. And yet, comics are a narrative medium. So when we publish this stuff as graphic novels, as comics, you know, people are reading a story and it's, you're not, you get engrossed in the story, and while you might appreciate the art, it's, you know, it's presented at a smaller size, and it doesn't sort of knock you on your ass in the way that these original pages will do. And I wanted to be able to give people that same kind of feeling that I get when I opened up a package of Frank's or, you know, Stan Sakai with Usagi, and I see these big, beautiful boards with just amazing, amazing artwork. That sadly is becoming obsolete as more and more people send in digital files and not actual art.
That was what made the Eisner sketchbook so great, too, because you really did get that feeling of from the drawing board into your hands. Before we finish, I wanted to ask about your class, which you briefly touched on. Can you describe it?
Well, it's a comics art history and criticism class that I teach every fall semester at Portland Community College, though I'm thinking of moving it to spring semester just because fall semester is so dark and rainy here in Portland. And we use Understanding Comics as our textbook.
That's cool.
And essentially, you know, the idea there is that comics loses a lot of readers sort of in later adolescence, you know, as our hormones kind of kick in and it becomes more important to hang out with the opposite sex and, you know, indulge all our various vices and so on. So a lot of the people at the college level, when they think of comics at all, they think of what they were reading when they were kids or younger teenagers, 12, 13, like that. And so what they're thinking of is superheroes primarily. And now they're in their early 20s, and they don't know that there are comics out there for them.
Sure.
They don't know how the medium has changed. I mean, gosh, you know, 30 years ago when I was getting back into comics, there was primarily only superheroes for me to get into. Superheroes and Howard the Duck. And it was Howard the Duck that really sort of sucked me right back in, because there was a comic that was speaking to me as a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, you know, I want to replicate that kind of experience for these kids, only now there is so much more to offer them. And they, you know, generally they, so many of them come out of the class going, oh my God, I didn't realize there was so much stuff available for me to read. You know, it's not all superheroes. So, you know, the purpose is to turn them on to the medium. That's kind of an overall purpose, or return them on to the medium, I guess, and get them to realize that the medium has grown up just as they have. Also to have them understand what it is that they see. I mean, comics is an amazing visual communication tool. Sometimes you really need to make people conscious, I guess, of what they see. They think they see rain, but in fact they see white lines on paper. And how cool is that, that the brain takes those white lines on a black background and translates that into rain.
That's cool.
So, yeah, there's, you know, a little bit of sort of aesthetics, philosophy of art in there as well.
Now, as a girl that grew up on comics, what were some of your favorites beyond, as you say, the Howard the Duck one, you know, at 20 brought you back in?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit of an anomaly in terms of female readers. Most of the women my age who were reading comics as a little girl were reading Archie's or the Funny Animal books, the Barksducks, whatever.
Uh-huh.
I was a Mort Weisinger baby. I read all those 60s Supermans.
That's cool.
Superman action, Lois Lane.
you bet. Did you like Jimmy Olsen, or was that too much of a boys' comic book?
Jimmy Olsen was a little bit of a boys' comic, but I still would read it. Supergirl, of course, was my favorite. She had backups in Action Comics. Mm-hmm. And the day Superman introduced her to the world was like just an incredible day in my life as a little girl.
That's right. She was the secret weapon for a long time.
Yes.
For a couple of years before they kind of made her public persona known.
That's exactly right.
Oh,
she was his hidden helper.
Yes.
Secret helper, yeah. And I was reading superheroes at a young and tender age, and I think, you know, by the time I hit age 11 or 12, I'd moved into reading romance comics, and then by the time I hit 14 and discovered boys and cigarettes and the late 60s, I stopped reading them for a while.
Well, sure. No, I was the same way. I think everyone kind of reaches that late teen point where, yeah, there are other things on our minds other than comic
mm-hmm.
books. But it's nice that you, as you say, and you're teaching your course, that you're showing that there is a reason to come back. And, you know, in some ways I think it's good and bad because, as you say, you grew up on the Weisinger Supermans. I did too. And I always feel like today's younger audience kind of looks back at the Golden and Silver Age and just kind of sneers at the lack of sophistication in some of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And if only they could see, you know, some of the fun that might be underneath that, you know, script that was written for 7 or 8 year olds and just appreciate the basic concepts and how much fun they are.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the books that, and that my students read, I bought these myself out of my own pocket a couple years ago when they came out. DC released this Golden Age sampler, which has
the dollar one that they did? I think it was something like
that. Yes, that's right. So
yeah,
it's got a Jerry Siegel written, I think Wayne Boring drawn Superman story from the 40s. And if it wasn't Wayne Boring, it was someone who worked in Schuster's studio.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who was basically drawing like him under his watchful eye. And then it's got a Jerry Robinson Batman, an H.G. Peter Wonder Woman, and most importantly, a Jack Cole Plastic Man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are various levels of sophistication to the writing and the art through those four different stories that are contained in this book. But I would put that Jack Cole Plastic Man up against anything out there today, you know.
No, I agree.
And I think the students begin to see that, the old stuff isn't, they can't quite turn their nose up at it.
That's cool. Well, and as we wrap up, I want to ask about Sexy Chicks. You briefly touched on it. I thought it was going to be more like Shop Talk and the Eisner Miller book, and that it was really going to be kind of a creator profile book. But it sounds like it is more of an anthology book as well.
It's an anthology of short stories written and drawn by a variety of women, among whom the coup, of course, is that I have a Joyce Carol Oates story in there.
Oh, that's great.
Which was pretty remarkable. And she was, Michael Chabon actually sent her my way, and she offered me up a short story of hers, and Lauren McCubbin is drawing it. And, there are a variety of, women in the anthology, contributing stories of all sorts. I mean, ranging from sort of the horror of child sexual abuse to, a day of shopping at the mall. The contributors range in age from 8 years old to 68 years old. This has been a book that I've wanted to do for a very long time, you know. Coming into comics about 25 years ago, there were not a lot of women for me to have as role models. Trina Robbins, Cat Ironwood,
mm-hmm.
That was kind of about it, you know.
Did you know Marie Severin?
I knew Marie, but at that time she was restricted to coloring comics.
Yeah, yeah. And Ramona Fraiden? Because, you know,
and I didn't know, and I did not know Ramona Fraiden's work.
Okay. Like,
back then.
I mean, it was an old boys school, and I don't doubt that, but I also sometimes wonder, and again, I don't mean to diminish what, you know, has come up, and I'm glad to see that there are more women involved, because it only means there's going to be more readers and more mm-hmm. diversity in comics. But was it, you know, was it really, you know, still very tough back then for say someone like yourself when you started a Kimiko or something like that? Was it difficult?
There were certain things that were curious. In many ways, I think that being a woman working in the industry when I got in was actually, it was kind of a plus in some ways. Being a female editor, working with primarily male creators, there's less competition. You know, you guys, it's all about, you know, who's got the biggest. And So, male editors working with male creators, there's an underlying competitive edge there.
Okay.
That I've seen happen before, you know, that can get adversarial. It's just not there or at least it's just never been there with me and the people that I've worked with, male or female. And sometimes, you know, sometimes a guy is just more comfortable with a woman. Let's not forget that freelancers work alone.
Certainly.
They're, you know, most of them, they're in a room, they're drawing all day, they're alone. And it's nice for them to have somebody that they can talk to. And sometimes it's less threatening to just sort of tell all to a woman as opposed to another guy. So in that sense, some paths were sort of made clearer for me as a woman working in the industry. But there were, you know, I worked with Bob Schreck at Kimiko, mm-hmm. and people everywhere knew who Bob was, and the fact that I was editor-in-chief at Kimiko went over some people's heads entirely, you know, and they would deal with Bob kind of exclusively. Once, maybe I can tell this story, once Bob and I were asking for a raise when we were at Kimiko, and we asked for the same amount of money, and they were, our employers were very quick to give it to Bob, but they turned to me and said, well, why should you make as much money as he does?
Wow.
So, you know, but that was then.
Wow, okay.
It's a whole lot better now
cool.
than it was then. There's no question of that. But yeah, traditionally comics has been a boys' club. I mean, look at what...
Well, what it was founded on, too, for that
yeah,
matter.
Yeah, what it published.
Sure. on the backs of early, you know, 30s softcore pornography in some
mm-hmm.
cases. And,
exactly right.
You know, let's,
yeah.
let's call it what it was, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of the kids know that these days, but, you know, there's books like Gerard Jones's book and everything that
mm-hmm.
kind of go back to that history. I'm looking forward to Sexy Chicks. Is there any other works coming up?
There's Harlan Ellison's Dream Corridor,
oh,
which we're planning for 2006, the second and last trade paperback volume, which will collect a variety of news stories by the likes of Gene Colan, Jay Lynch, Richard Corbin, Steve Niles, Steve Rude. Those are the people who are immediately coming to mind. There are more.
That's cool.
Along with a few reprints, so that ultimately all the Harlan Ellison Dream Corridor material will be available within two trade paperbacks, the first of which was released in 96,
yeah.
the second of which is being released summer of 2006. And then 2007 is the 25th anniversary of Grendel.
Wow.
So, yeah, wow is right.
That's pretty amazing.
You know, when I think that I started working with Matt in 1985, 20 years ago. My God, it's so weird. But we have, Matt and I are planning all sorts of things for the 25th anniversary, including, of course, an Art of Grendel. So,
wow, that's great.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Is there this shorthand now between the two of you when it comes to Grendel projects? I mean, you know, you've been involved as long as you have, and of course the family dynamic too. Now, he's your brother-in-law, is that correct?
He is my brother-in-law, yes.
How's that work?
I introduced him to my younger sister, my middle sister Barbara.
Okay.
About a year or two after Matt and I had started working together, she came to visit, and I introduced the two of them, and it was love at first sight. They married in 88. They moved in together in 87. They married in 88. And my nephew is 15 and my niece is 12. So, yeah, there's a whole family dynamic. Generally, when the whole family gets together, you'll find me and Matt in the corner talking about comics.
That's cool. Well, that's great. I look forward to that stuff coming up in 2007. And great to hear that Dream Corridor is coming back and you're finishing collecting it, because it was a great book. I enjoyed reading the issues when they'd come out and appreciated the fact that it was creators. And, you know, sometimes there were spaces, you know, you'd go months without seeing a Dream Corridor, but we were always anxious to get another issue. So this is great that it's being collected and new stuff is coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harlan, you know, I basically said to Harlan, look, this is it. We're doing it. We're going to do this, and you're going to write what you have to write, or I'm shit canning the whole project. Anyway, I flew to LA, and we spent 3 days sort of tearing our hair out, yelling at each other, and you know, screaming and yelling and crying and making up, and at the end of it all, we had a new book, so we were both thrilled to death.
That's cool. Well, we look forward to it. That's great. Well, Diana, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today. And
all right. Well, thank you, John. You know, need all the help we can get with comics. You know, and so I'm glad that you're out there pushing for us.
No, just talking about good material. So thank you guys for producing such great stuff at Dark Horse, and specifically the books you work on as well.
You know, I got to meet Diana at the following San Diego Comic-Con the next year, and she was so sweet and really a nice woman. I met her at the Eisner Awards and was very kind, and she was flush with another Eisner victory, so I was just very pleased to be able to congratulate her in person and thank her again for the wonderful interview. And that's all the time we have here at Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. Right now, you can get both volumes of Michael Chabon's Presents The Amazing Adventures of the Escapist, Volumes 1 and 2. They both retail for $17.95, but at InStockTrades.com, you can get them for $11.67. And don't forget to visit InStockTrades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your monthly pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off. They have monthly specials every month, 45 to 75% off. For more details, visit their websites, InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the Internet. We're at WordBalloon.com. We're, of course, at Newsarama.com. We have our MySpace page, MySpace.com/WordBalloon. Any questions or comments on the show, you can always email me, John@WordBalloon.com. Now, I'm sure there's going to be tons of news and creators just waiting to tell their stories post-San Diego, so have a great time, enjoy the coverage of the convention, and we will talk to you once the convention is over. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2008.